Count to seven.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
We're talking to Gene Tidball in Missoula, Montana. It's, I believe, the 30th of September, 2005. And Gene, you were brought up, I believe, in Billings, went to law school. Tell us a little bit about your early life.
Okay, Bob, it's actually October 1st.
Is it okay?
my parents moved to Billings in 1939, and I was in fourth grade. So I went all through grade school and high school in Billings. I joined the Army and then started the University of Montana in 1949 and graduated there with degrees in business and law in 1955. Then after a year in Casper, Wyoming, I was appointed to be the first director of the Montana Legislative Council, which was a wonderful opportunity and a wonderful job because I felt like that was where I really belonged. I never really wanted to practice law, and here's a chance, I felt, to really leave an imprint on state of Montana government, because in 1957, when I was appointed, the state of government was very primitive. We were living with a 19th century constitution, and nobody had ever really seriously and continuously studied government. So I felt great about getting that job, and I was there for 8 years. We did a lot of things in terms of reorganizing state government and creating some efficiencies. Prior to the time that we set up our bill drafting service, there were a couple of bill drafters hired by the House and the Senate, but the big corporations really did a lot of the drafting work. And of course, that gave them an opportunity to not only draft legislation, but to influence it. And that continued on even after we started. There were some legislators that just preferred to have their bills drafted by Anaconda Company lawyers or Power Company lawyers. We did a study on legislative services that was headed up by John Cabin, a Republican of Yellowstone County. And one of the things we determined to do was to put an end to the letterpress printing of bills, where everything had to be set in type, and it was a very laborious, expensive process, and use an offset method. And offset printing was just coming into its own then. It was quite new. So the committee decided to adopt that, and Jerry Anderson, who was the majority leader in the House from Billings, got behind it, and Jerry, if he wanted something, well, he usually got it, because he was a very strong leader in the House. Well, one of the things that happened toward the end of the study, we were trying to account for all of the bills that were introduced, that is, the copies of each bill. Five copies were required. So we found out that one was sent to committee, one was sent to engrossing, one was sent to enrolling, one was sent somewhere else. And we don't know what happened to the fifth copy. And I should have been able to find that out because I was a researcher and full-time up there, but it was a mystery. And one day Jerry walked into my office kind of apologetically and almost red-faced, and he said, "Well, I find out where the fifth copy goes." I said, "Really? Where does it go?" He says, "It goes to the company." So it turned out all these years, the Anaconda Company was getting a copy of every bill that was introduced as soon as it hit the speaker's podium. So we put a stop to that, obviously, and only one copy of the bill was introduced, and then reproductions were made by offset. So that gives you an idea of the overhang of corporate influence in those days, even after the power and the influence of the big companies had diminished somewhat.
This would have been when, Gene, about 1959, 57, 58?
This would have been probably about 1960.
About 1960.
Yeah, or 61.
And prior to 61, if I could just interject here, or prior to about 1960, there was really very little legislative staff. Is that right?
Oh, there was none except for the clerks, and they were all
just temporary.
Yeah, they were all temporary. They were all political appointees. And one of the things that I felt very strongly about, and this was something that the council had more or less inspired me to do from the very beginning, was to work toward a legislative budget analyst, which was non-existent at the time, and a legislative post auditor. We started out in the council. The first study we did was to create an executive budget director. And there was quite a bit of a problem about that because people thought it was giving the governor too much power. They said it's just going to play politics with it. Well, the answer was the budget is politics. It's supposed to be in politics. That's what government's all about. The governor can run on his budget. So that bill passed. And then to counterbalance the power that we had awarded to the executive branch, we thought the legislative branch should be able to should have some capability to analyze the governor's executive budget. So we did work on that, and the last thing that happened before I resigned in 1965 was to get through the reports recommending both the legislative post auditor and the legislative fiscal analyst. And it took a couple of years after that before they finally passed, but they did.
So there was really no staff in the Montana legislature until this period. So essentially the corporations or the lobbyists or the lawyer from home that would help you draft your bill, whoever he was essentially the legislative staff. And then I suppose, you know, if you had to work out an amendment there in the legislature, you'd get some legislator who was skillful at doing that to help you because there was no staff. So what you were involved in the ground floor of was the what we then called the Legislative Council or the Legislative Services Division, which provided some kind of staffing, bill drafting service, preparing amendments, doing research and so on for the legislature, which had never existed in Montana until that time. And then you mentioned the Legislative Post Audit Committee.
Yes.
What did it do?
Well, the theory behind that was, and this was a fairly well-accepted concept in other states. The governor had the power to devise and present the budget, and the controller's office at that time had the power to disperse the money. But the auditor was also in the executive branch, and we thought that the legislature should audit the way the executive branch spent the money. So that's why that committee was set up.
And it literally performed an audit function.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then you mentioned the legislative fiscal analyst, because we've already created you mentioned that the governor's budget office had already been created to formally prepare a budget, but there needed to be some legislative oversight or analysis of that budget, and that's where the legislative fiscal analyst's office came from, and that occurred also in the middle 1960s or early 1960s.
That's correct, Bob. The governor had a budget director and a small staff, and after we passed that bill, got that bill introduced and it was passed, it was just dumped on the Appropriations Committee in the House. So they're sitting up there, they're sitting up there in the Appropriations Committee room right off the House chambers with no staff at all except the secretary. So all these farmers and cowboys and from all over the state had to sit down with this gigantic budget and paw through it trying to figure out what the hell it meant. So they desperately needed some staff, and ultimately we did recommend that be provided.
And obviously if you were a corporation such as the Anaconda Company with lawyers and offices and space and equipment and that sort of thing, you'd be in a wonderful position to help the legislature do this sort of thing, but by the same token, the legislature would be dependent on you for these services.
Yeah, that's correct. And I don't think the corporations were real happy with the creation of the Legislative Council, but they saw it coming and really didn't try to interfere with it, and the bills creating the council passed handily. So they
was there important opposition, do you remember?
Well, not that I'm aware of. There were two court challenges, and It was the second Supreme Court that finally approved the bill, but as far as I know, and of course this was before I was hired, so I'm not sure, as far as I know, there was no serious challenge from any of the large corporations. I just sensed that there was probably some lack of enthusiasm.
You mentioned the key legislator, Jerome Anderson, Jerry Anderson, and I believe John Cabin, both Republicans, both members of House of Representatives from Billings.
Yes.
Who, from as I understand what you've told us here today, were pretty instrumental in helping get some kind of legislative staff and modernization of our legislature started here. Were there other key legislators you can remember that were involved?
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of them. John Cabin just happened to be chairman of the Legislative Services Committee. Bill McKay was my principal mentor, I would say. Bill was very interested in fiscal procedures, and he was the one that got behind the executive budget first on. And then all the time I was on the council, Bill was right there. He was chairman 1 year, and he's the one that pushed reorganization of the controller's office. We created a Department of Administration. He's the one that pushed the legislative fiscal analyst, the legislative post audit. Bill was intensely interested in the money, to follow the money, to see where the money went. And of course, he was right about that. And Bill was a very wonderful person, in addition to being so concerned about fiscal affairs. Bob Durkee, another one of the original council members, and one of the chairmen I worked under.
Now, Gene, we talk about council members, just so someone listening to this tape later on would remember. The Legislative Council is what you're referring to, and that was just the interim committee made up of Democrats, Republicans, senators, and representatives that met during the interim. It probably was about the only interim committee early on that met, that just kind of oversaw whatever legislative function occurred during the interim.
Well, it really had a very limited oversight function. What it did was to conduct studies.
Okay.
It consisted of six House members and six Senate members, three from each party, from each House.
Yeah.
So strictly bipartisan. But we conducted studies at the
but
end.
But then when you were brought on board and given a limited staff, they were the folks basically who you reported to.
I served at their pleasure.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and every year they renewed my contract, so to speak. I mean, that they didn't have to, but
Legislative Council, when we refer to the Legislative Council, I guess we kind of understand that to be both the committee and the committee staff. When we think of Legislative Council, we just kind of think of the, you know, this overseeing committee that met during the interval between legislative sessions. But then we also think, when we think of the Legislative Council, at least when I do, of the staff that was created to help the legislature manage its functions.
Yeah.
Under the supervision of the legislative council.
Legislative Council was an interim committee.
Yeah, yeah.
And its charter, a statutory charter, was to conduct studies, prepare legislation, and try to improve state government. And then it was up to the council to hire staff.
Yeah.
And they hired me. And I hired an assistant. I had a temporary assistant during the 1959 session and then hired a permanent assistant. But by the time I left 8 years later, we only had a staff of four or five people, so it was really quite small. We got a hell of a lot done, though, because the council only met once a month, and the subcommittees met sometimes once a month, sometimes once every 2 months. So we were up there, the two or three of us, just working all day long on these studies. And we accomplished, in my opinion, quite a great deal during those 8 years.
And then too, Gene, when the legislature was in session and before it was in session, did legislators begin then a new tradition of coming to you and your staff for bill drafts, or did they continue to have the... How did that evolve?
Okay, they did start coming to us. During the very first session, as I recall, the House and Senate each hired bill drafters. And then after that, they left it up to the council. And I inaugurated a bill drafting program, and I must have drafted 300 bills myself during the time I was there. And then I would hire a temporary lawyer, and the two of us would work almost full-time on drafting bills, and we had plenty of work to do. Especially the newer legislators would come to us regularly. And then I finally added a full-time lawyer to the staff a couple years before I left. So yes, the tradition began, and we also instituted the first pre-session caucus to give the legislature a chance to organize before they came to Helena, because one of the problems was they'd come to Helena and they hadn't elected their speakers or their leaders, the committees hadn't been appointed, and it'd take 10 or 12, 15 days sometimes to get the committees appointed, and not much happened during that period of time. So we had our first pre-session caucus in Bozeman sometime in the early 60s, I guess it was. And that was just an example of the kind of improvements that we continuously attempted to make in the legislative process.
Is that when Clyde Hawkes became speaker?
Well, Clyde was speaker about that time.
Or maybe when Hazel Baker was the...
Well, Hazel Baker was speaker too. Yeah. I'm not sure which came first.
Well, Hawkes came before Hazel Baker, but I'm just wondering whether the Bozeman caucus resulted in, the pre-session caucus resulted in Hawkes or Hazel Baker.
I just don't recall, Bob, who it was, but they got their speakers appointed and their majority leaders appointed, and they started working on committee appointments. So by the time the first day of the session, everything was in place.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have to waste that first week or
exactly.
two in organization.
Yeah.
Yeah. You, one time earlier, we had a talk, and you'd mentioned that one of the other legislators early on who was instrumental in modernizing our legislature and establishing the Legislative Council and services and so on was Senator Dave James.
Yes. Dave was very important for this reason. He was a highly respected legislator from Liberty County by both parties. He was kind of a Lincoln-esque figure. He was tall and dignified and taciturn, didn't ever get involved in anything flamboyant, didn't get too excited about politics. But he was appointed the first chairman of the council. And Dave didn't contribute particularly a lot toward the studies that we were doing, but he had a very a firm hand in guiding the council through the first 2 years and in maintaining a strictly bipartisan attitude. So he was important for that reason.
You've mentioned some legislators. We've talked about them, Bill McKay and Dave James and Jerome Anderson, who obviously stood out in your mind or stand out in your mind from their involvement with you. Are there any other legislators you can think of that good or bad, made a prominent impression on you during that period?
Yeah, I got to know Ted Swindon very well. And Ted, of course, is a very bright guy. He was a PhD candidate at one time in economics and came off the farm in Wolf Point. And Ted jumped right in. He was very bright. He understood what it was all about.
He was a young state representative then from Wolf Point.
Yeah, that's right. He was there for three sessions. And then I think he finally was beat by Lauren Casey. But he was on the council for 3 or 4 years. We became very well acquainted. Gene Turnage, who later became Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, was a council member. There were a lot of Jack Brenner, a wonderful guy from Beaverhead County, was a member. Then we had a lot of subcommittee members. I think by the time I left, there was a list of over 100 legislators that had been either on the council or on a subcommittee. And I have to say that with a rare exception of maybe one or two, maybe three at the most, I got along with all of them, and I respected all of them. They were idiosyncratic in some ways, and they were different, but most of them were well-intentioned and quite effective. And then, of course, reapportionment came right in the middle of all of that, and all of a sudden, we had a lot fewer farmers and ranchers and a lot more lawyers and insurance salesmen. that created a very large difference in the makeup of the legislature, but the council went on just the same as always.
You described Dave James as Lincoln-esque and taciturn.
Yes.
Are there any terms that pop into your mind if I asked you to describe Ted Swindon when you knew him?
Yeah. Ted was very articulate, and he was suspect because I remember a Republican lobbyist telling me that guy's a farmers union sellout, you know, and he was very liberal. There's no question about it. We used to sit around and talk about things like that sometimes after meetings, and he had his theories on dividing the wealth. He became more conservative as years went on and when he became governor. But Ted was very bright, very full of ideas. Oh, and John Melcher was another council member who later became a United States Senator. John was kind of a diehard party man. He was a Democrat, and in a way that you don't see too often, but I remember he was the sole holdout when we wanted to abolish the auditor's office, because Johnny Holmes was a Democrat that had been elected with Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Melcher just couldn't bring himself to vote to get rid of Johnny Holmes. But we got along well, and there were a lot of interesting personalities.
Would you have predicted that Schwinden might someday have been governor, or that John Melcher might someday have been a United States Senator?
Never Melcher. Oh, and Tom Judge was another one. I would never have predicted Tom would be governor. He was in the House of Representatives, and he was on the council. And when I left the state, after I had left the council, in fact, I was overseas working, I came back and found that Tom Judge was the governor and John Melcher was in Congress, and I almost fainted because I just didn't see that in either of them.
They didn't seem to show the promise to you that Schwinden did?
I think that would be a fair statement, yeah.
Anything else you want to say about that?
Well, if I could think of something else to say, I would.
Okay,
I would. There are a lot of
people listening to this tape at some future time might wonder why. What was it about Tom Judge, or what was it about John Melcher that made you think, gosh, I can't believe that guy's a U.S. Senator, that guy's a governor?
Yeah. Well, as you know, Bob, a lot of politicians are accidents. I mean, they just happen to be there at the right time. And I didn't have anything against either John Melcher or Tom Judge. I would never have described Tom Judge as anything more than kind of a lightweight. An engaging guy, but Melcher was serious. He was very serious about his work and being, he was first in the State House and then in the State Senate. But I just, you could go through the House and Senate now and try to pick on who is the next governor going to be, who's the next U.S. Senator, and I think you'd have a hard time picking him out.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, you left state government service. You left your position as the chief of staff for the Legislative Council in about 1965 or 66?
65.
And then what did you do?
Well, I can tell you how it happened. I was sitting in my office one day in 1965, and Lou Brown, who was a senior counsel for the Anaconda Company, with whom I was acquainted, walked in my office and said, I see that you're coming over to Butte to give a speech to the Silver Bow County Bar Association in a couple weeks. I said, yeah. He said, well, have you ever thought about coming to work for the Anaconda Company? And I said, no, I really haven't. He said, well, Bill Kirkpatrick, the Western General Counsel, would like to talk to you when you come over to give that speech. So that was the first that I'd heard about it. I had thought about leaving the council because it was beginning to wear a little bit, but I hadn't really made any strong effort to find another job, and I still wasn't thrilled with the idea of going out and practicing law on the street. So I did go over to make that speech without any intention at all of accepting a position. But Bill Kirkpatrick got me up in his office on the sixth floor of the Hennessy Building, and as I walked along and noticed the thick carpet and the walnut paneling, I thought, gee, this is a pretty good life compared to the linoleum we had in our office in Helena. And he talked to me for about an hour before I gave my speech, and then about an hour afterwards. And I finally began to waver. And I said, well, Bill, if I were to come to work for the Anaconda Company, slipped into the subjunctive mood, I said, there's a number of projects I would have to clean up before I could feel good about walking away. He said, we'll wait a whole year for you. So I knew then that he really wanted me to come. So it didn't take a year. That was in probably July or August, and by the 1st of October, I had things rolling along pretty well and had wound up the reports that I desperately wanted to finish before I left, and went to work in Butte on December 1st, 1965, as counsel for the Anaconda Company.
So you worked under Bill Kirkpatrick? He was the chief counsel.
He was the Western General Counsel. And that's a position that in those days carried a tremendous amount of prestige and importance. Roy Glover and Dan Kelly had been previous Western General Counsels. Glover became chairman of the company. And those were the days when the sixth floor of the Hennessy Building was almost like going back into time.
The Western General Counsel, Gene, was kind of the, how would you describe the job?
Okay, he reported to the General Counsel in New York, but he was in charge of all the legal affairs west of the Mississippi, basically, that had to do with mining, smelting, and refining. And for that matter, the smelter in Anaconda, the refinery in Great Falls, were both under him. He had the legal control over all of the Western operations of the Anaconda Company.
Which included the lobbying operations.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Bill was very active in the lobby. And at that time, we had an elaborate lobby. We had the infamous hospitality room. But the first session I went over there was in 67. And by that time, Bill had gone back to New York, and Largy McDonald had taken over charge of that. But we had two or three secretaries. We had two lobbyists, Lloyd Crippen and Glenn Carney. And we had two lawyers. We had a staff of five or six people over there.
The lawyers were Largy McDonald and?
Well, Largy McDonald and Lou Brown and me.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Were the three lawyers over there when I was... That was the only session that I worked in Helena full time. And we went over there the first day of the session and worked the whole time.
Tell us a little bit about the hospitality room.
Well, it used to be in the Finland Hotel.
You don't mean Finland, do you? Finland's in Butte.
No, the Placer.
Placer Hotel in
Helena. Placer Hotel. And my first session, Largy and I went over together, and he said, this is the hospitality room. And so we all stayed at the Finland, and we opened it up, and the first night, I think one or two guys showed up, and it was kind of a dreary atmosphere, and Largy said, you know, we ought to move this thing, and I said, I agree with you. So the two of us just made the decision to move it out to Jorgensen's, and we did. We shut it down at the Placer and moved it out to Jorgensen's.
Before we leave the Placer, because I imagine the room you guys were in was the same one that had traditionally been the hospitality room of the Anaconda Company?
Oh, yeah, for many years.
Was it large, small? How would you describe it?
I was only up there that one time. It was not huge. It was like maybe the size of two or three hotel rooms, you know, put together.
Yeah.
And it had a little bar at one end and just a place for people to mix. The place out at Jorgensen's was a lot brighter, and people liked it better. It was close to the Capitol.
And what took place there? Describe a typical end-of-the-day session there at your hospitality suite at Jorgensen's.
The Anaconda Company staff that was working over there were expected to show up and act as hosts for legislators, and I did that. And a lot of legislators showed up.
Of course, you knew them because you'd been the...
I'd been in the legislative council. And there was a lot of socializing. I don't remember a lot of serious business being talked about. I think the main thing from the Anaconda Company's point of view was just to make the contacts, to buy legislators' drinks. We'd have a big piece of roast beef up there, and they'd come up and slice off some roast beef, and... bring their wives with them usually, and stand around and talk. And I'm sure there was some business discussed. As I say, I can't remember anything getting very intense, but no doubt somebody said, oh, by the way, that bill that was introduced, you know, we're going to kill that or something. It was that kind of conversation.
Do you recall any kind of a reputation that it might have had, such as maybe a partisan Democrat like John Melcher or a very liberal Democrat like Ted Swindon might not have been caught dead there? Or was it the kind of a place where it was just kind of generally assumed that you just mixed and mingled without regard to philosophy? How would you describe
that? Bob, I'm sure there were some legislators that wouldn't be caught dead there. We used to see probably predominantly Republican, although those few Democrats used to hang out there a lot, and it was fairly bipartisan, but some of the legislators weren't interested in drinking or socializing, and they just didn't enjoy the social atmosphere there, and so I'm not quite ready yet. So they just didn't show up. But I did never know of a head count or of anybody doing an analysis of who came in. It would be interesting, actually, if we knew. But I think there was a lot of repeat business.
What was your lobbying strategy? I mean, obviously, part of it was to make connections and to be hospitable in the hospitality room, but there were also pieces of legislation, certainly, that were of important concern to the Anaconda Company.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
What did you...
Well, we had bill readers, and I was a bill reader that one session. It was terrible drudgery. Sit there and pour through those bills all day long, some of them so badly drafted you couldn't understand them. And then we'd talk to other lobbyists and find out about bills that did certain things. Obviously, the ones that had a direct impact on the company, like taxation, someone wanted to introduce a metal mines tax or increase the net proceeds tax, or environmental legislation that would directly affect our operations. Those were the bills that were at the top of the list. We had a little black book we carried around with summaries of bills in them, and there were some bills in there that really were only peripherally of interest to us, and that was about the point in time when the Anaconda Company had withdrawn from essentially taking a position on every bill. The power company had not done that. And I can tell you a little story to demonstrate it. When I was working for the Legislative Council, I was up in the House lobby, excuse me, and George O'Connor was there. George had been Speaker of the House and then went to work for the power company and was their chief lobbyist at that time. He later became president of the power company. George was standing in the lobby and he was just ranting. He said, "This damn bill has no business passing the Montana legislature, just another piece of crap," and he went on and on, and I couldn't imagine what he was talking about. Well, it turned out it was a bill to require colored photographs on driver's licenses, and he just saw this as an unnecessary government expense and the kind of thing that he would lobby against. Well, the Anaconda Company had quit doing that a long time ago. So
you wonder what in the world a colored photograph on a driver's license would have to do with anything that would be important to the Montana Power.
Yeah, except
Company.
It'd cost another 50 cents, and it'd, yeah, it'd be like an added tax or something.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But everything the government does costs money.
But your impression, Gene, was that earlier on the Anaconda Company took an interest in about everything, including driver's licenses.
By
the time you came on board, it had kind of tried to narrow its focus. But the old Montana Power Company was still trying to be involved in everything.
Yeah, that's my impression, and I'm sure it was true to some extent. The Power Company and the Anaconda Company split up, so to speak, in 1957, at the time when Bill Kirkpatrick was appointed Western General Counsel. They used to have a joint legal department on the sixth floor of the Hennessy Building, where I worked. 10 years previously, the power company lawyers were up there too. Bill Coldiron and Bob Corrett, and they had a joint department. Well, this is hearsay, so I have to make sure you understand this, but my impression is, and I have pretty good sources, was that Bob Corrett wanted that Western General Counsel's job, because it was a great job. It was a very powerful job and very prestigious. Instead, Kirkpatrick got it, and Bob Corrett pulled his lawyers out of the Hennessy building, moved them over to the power company headquarters, and that was really the split. Now, there were no bad feelings between the two companies, although some people were surprised to see that the Anaconda Company appeared as a protestant at a power company rate increase hearing. That's something that never happened before. But the relationship was congenial, but it was not collegial, let me put it that way.
Yeah. Would you inform each other? Like, do you remember who the Montana Power Company lobbyists were during that period?
Oh, John Lahr was up there, and Ev Shuey, I think. I didn't do a lot of that. Lou Brown was very busy up there. He talked to all the lobbyists and kind of would get tips from them about what's coming up.
So he might have networked with them and with others?
A little bit, yeah. I don't know that any deals were made, but sure. There was a lot of information exchanged. And then, of course, Lloyd Crippen and Denny Shea, after Glenn Carney retired, were up there full-time lobbying. I mean, that was their job. And so those lobbyists spent a lot of time talking to each other. So we knew what they were talking about for the most part, and they knew what we were talking about.
Bill Kirkpatrick and I had a wonderful series of conversations. Actually, he's deceased now, of course, as you know, but about some of he mentioned to me strategy sessions. He mentioned to me the large room at the Placer Hotel, and he mentioned to me that apparently a number of times while he was Western General Counsel, or at least when he was in Helena during legislative sessions and probably had that job, I'm thinking this could have been maybe in the 57 and 59 legislative session period, he remembers little sessions involving some of the key Anaconda Company lobbying people, maybe members of his legal staff, along with key legislators over there maybe in the room at the Placer Hotel after everyone had gone away, or maybe in some adjacent room rather, to kind of discuss legislative strategy. Do you remember any sessions like that that you were involved in?
I really don't, Bob, although I probably was. I probably was at some time. I didn't shy away from talking to legislators about things like that. I did not like lobbying. After 8 years working for a bipartisan committee, yeah. I just didn't like asking legislators to vote a certain way. But a couple of times I was dragooned into taking somebody to lunch and talking to them about a tax bill, because I knew quite a bit about property taxes, and there was a certain amount of that, and I'm sure a lot of it went on that I didn't even know about.
And so you were there primarily in the 1967 session?
Yeah, that's the only session that I worked there full-time as a staff lawyer. And Bill Kirkpatrick, to give you a little history of what happened to that job, Bill Kirkpatrick, after about a year after I came to work, was promoted, went back to New York as vice president in charge of industrial relations and personnel and that sort of thing. And the position of Western General Counsel was abolished. So that was the end of an era. Bill Kirkpatrick had a car and a chauffeur when I came to work in Butte in 1965. I mean, whoever heard of that, you know, in Butte, Montana. And a couple other guys did too. Ed Renoir, who was the vice president, he retired shortly after that. And the general manager had big company cars and chauffeurs. So the company was living in the past a little bit. But anyway, when Bill was sent back to New York, the job was dismantled, and Cress Sear became manager of the legal department, and Largy MacDonald took over the legislative function. And then shortly after that, the entire Western legal supervisory process was divided into three parts. There was an assistant general counsel in Butte, there was an assistant general counsel in Salt Lake City, and an assistant general counsel in Tucson, Arizona. And they reported back to New York. So the head lawyer in Butte no longer had all of that authority and all of that territory.
Your office was in Butte?
Yes.
And were you the head lawyer in Butte? Do I understand that?
No, not at that time. Now, I left Butte in 1968 and was transferred to Salt Lake City and worked for a guy named Howard Edwards, who was another assistant general counsel. And we had a lot of activity down there, mainly in exploration. And that's where Jay Parkinson was from, who became chairman of the board. So he built up that Salt Lake City facility, and it was sort of the world headquarters for exploration. And then in 1970, I was transferred to Sydney, Australia, as counsel for Anaconda Australia Inc., which was a subsidiary, and I spent 2 years in Sydney. And then I came back to Tucson and spent 3 years in Tucson. And all of that time I was either just a counsel or a senior counsel. And then I was transferred to Butte and became vice president in charge of legal, environmental, and governmental affairs.
And about when would that have been?
That would have been in 75.
I see. And of course, the environmental issues were becoming a little more controversial, I guess.
Oh, they were huge. When I left Butte, there were no environmental issues. And they didn't teach environmental law in law school when I went to law school. But the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Mine Land Reclamation Act, all of those things came on, and it was a huge part of my work. The head environmental guy reported to me, but then, of course, there were a lot of legal components to the environmental part, and the smelter was our big problem. We had a huge problem with the smelter. We finally had to shut it down. So I did that. At the same time, I had the governmental affairs work, which meant that the head person in Helena, who at that time was a guy named Bill Sternhagen, reported to me. So in effect, I was in charge of the lobby, but I didn't spend much time over there. And by that time, the hospitality room had closed, yeah, as I recall. And the legislature passed a few laws which severely limited gifts for legislators. The company used to always provide a case of whiskey to the courthouse party every Christmas in Butte during my first tour of duty in Butte. And the county clerk and the county attorney and the county assessor and all their staff would, you know, drink that whiskey, and they liked that. Well, when I came back to Butte in 75, I told one of my lawyers, I said, we got to stop that. I said, that's contrary to the statute, for one thing. You can't be handing out cases of whiskey to public officials. He said, oh, you can't stop that. He said, oh, he said, there'd be a revolt. I said, well, we're going to. And he said, well, he said, okay, so I'm going to buy a case of whiskey and put it on my expense account. I said, okay, you can do that once. I said, but that's the last time. And I said, that's not company money, that's your money. And if your expense account can stand scrutiny, we'll see. And but it was so hard for them to break away from these old habits, you know.
Yeah.
And another example of a kind of hangover of the old days, when I was first in Butte, it was Friday afternoon, and Largie was gone, and I think I may have been the only lawyer up there. Well, who should walk in my office but a guy named Sid Stewart, who was a district judge in Anaconda. And he said, I couldn't find Largie, he said, so I thought I'd better stop by and talk to you. I said, well, yeah, have a chair. And so he said, I just wanted to tell you that I just filed for re-election. And I said, oh. And he said, this is what you're supposed to do. He said, you come up here and tell the legal department when you file for re-election. I said, well, that's fine, Sid. Well, and then he left. So I thought, this is the way it used to be. You know, when anybody was going to run for public office, they'd come up and sort of check around with the company, or at least inform them about it. And I could have cared less. I don't think the company could have either. But there was still that feeling of what it was like in the old days. And that continued on for a long time. There's a statement made by an old British admiral or somebody, the appearance of power is power. And a lot of people still thought that the Anacana Company, if not running the state, had a lot of influence. And we really didn't have that much by the time I got there. But a lot of people thought we did. So that made it a bit interesting.
Now, you were there, I guess, in the waning days of the Anaconda Company's great power. You've mentioned it. I guess the common belief is that perhaps in the 20s and 30s and 40s, the Anaconda Company dominated Montana.
I think so, yeah.
And did you ever talk to anybody from that period that...
Well, my first wife's grandfather, W.J. McMahon, was majority leader in the House in 1913, 15, and 17, I think. He was there when Charlie Russell presented that wonderful painting behind the rostrum. But he said we had the Silver Bowl people locked up. He said we had the Anaconda people locked up. We said we had a lot of ranchers that voted with us. And he just made it very clear that whatever they wanted to happen in the legislature would happen. And he was labor commissioner for the Anaconda Company. So he was an executive with the company, but he was serving in the legislature. Now that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
That was the time of the First World War. But my impression is, Bob, that it continued up, and there's a lot of history on this that you could find someplace else, but it continued up, you know, into the 40s and 50s. And then about the time that split came with the power company in the late 50s is when the Anaconda Company really began to back away.
You came on board at the Anaconda Company then in December of 65, I think.
Yes.
You said. And in the article that you wrote for the Montana Magazine that I read, you comment about how you were there, and you describe how posh it was beautifully carpeted and furnished and that sort of thing. And then later on, you came back after the Chuquis Kamata mine disaster and when the Anaconda Company was entering on hard times, and you described the threadbare carpet,
yeah,
and so on. And in your article, of course, you described the rather precipitous, rather quick decline and collapse, really even more than fall, of the Anaconda Company. And it's a big story and a great story and an interesting story, but maybe we could kind of, in this part of our interview, kind of focus on that.
Sure.
On your experiences coming on board and then what led to the rapid fall of the Anaconda Company.
Yeah, well, I should say that when my first tour in Butte in the 60s, we were the largest non-ferrous mining company in the world. And we had Chuquis Kamata, which was the world's greatest mine. It was a wonderful mine. A big open pit mine.
In Chile.
2% copper.
Which is very rich copper, right?
Oh, yeah. Because now they're mining 0.2%. The price of copper was about 32 cents or 31 cents.
A pound?
A pound in the 60s when I came to work there. We were mining in Butte for about 31 cents, we were making a penny a pound maybe. They were mining it in Chile for 14 cents. So this was a huge source of income. This is what the Anaconda Company lived on. So the Anaconda Company got kind of lazy, got a little bit sloppy, because we had this huge fat cow down in Chile that was just pouring money into the Anaconda Company coffers. So that's the way it was when I first went to work for the company. Then Eduardo Frei expropriated half the properties, and then
he was a president, a politician in Chile.
He was just a moderate liberal Democrat, but he decided it was time to end that era of company domination of natural resources.
So did he buy it or did he take it?
He supposedly bought it, but he didn't give us much money for it. It was an expropriation with some compensation, and then Salvador Allende came along, and you know that story.
He was more of a radical.
Oh,
yeah,
oh, he was a communist, yeah.
And he followed Frei as the president of Chile.
Yeah, that's right.
And he, what did he do? He just confiscated what was left.
Oh, yeah, he took what was ever left, and was going to transform Chile into a completely socialist country. And then that's when the revolution came, and I'm trying to think of the name of the general who is still alive that they're trying to send to prison.
Pinochet.
Pinochet, yeah. That's when Pinochet overthrew Allende. But anyway,
but the Anaconda Company didn't get its mine back, its property back after.
No. However, we did recover some money from the Federal Insurance Protection Corporation that insures foreign investments. We I think we sued them, and we got some of the money back. Meanwhile, I had all of this happened when I was in Salt Lake City in Australia, and then I came back to Butte, and we were struggling along trying to make a go of it with just our domestic properties.
Because the cash cow was Chile.
Oh, it's gone, yeah.
And it was just a calamity to lose that.
Oh, yes.
And when the company lost that, then it tried to recoup by reorganizing domestically to try to...
Yeah.
You know, in your article too, Gene, I think I remember reading that the Anaconda Company was the largest, what? Non-metalliferous...
Well, that's what I just... It's the largest non-ferrous mining company in the world.
And so what does that mean?
Well, it means that that in the world, we mine more copper, lead, zinc, everything but iron than any other company, more than Phelps Dodge, more than Asarco, more than Kennecott. We were the biggest. And a lot of that was due to Chile.
Yeah. So when you lost Chile, then you might have realized that some of the rest of this operation, a lot of it probably wasn't that profitable.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't realize maybe how important Chile was in carrying the whole thing. So when Chile's gone, this is a huge disaster.
It was. And that's why the threadbare carpet in Butte. Len Powell was president of the company then, and he was struggling to try to make some money up there. And we were right on the edge. We were just barely getting by. And so I was in Butte from 75 until 77. And that's when Atlantic Richfield bought the Anaconda Company.
There was some effort made, though, wasn't there, in the near term by some guy, Evans, I think was
his
name?
Oh, Mellon.
Something, Richard Mellon Evans,
I think. Yeah, he was related to the Mellon family. I think his last name was Evans. Yeah, he was going to try to take the company over.
And there was some connection to an outfit, a Crane outfit?
Yes. Crane. Well, what Anaconda did, see, Evans owned the Crane Plumbing Company. Okay. I mean, that was one of his companies. And so the Anaconda Company went out and bought a little Mexican plumbing company to try to set up some kind of an antitrust thing that say one plumbing company can't buy another plumbing company, you know.
And the reason that the Anaconda Company didn't want to be bought out by Evans was that Evans had a reputation for buying companies and plundering them.
Exactly. Yeah. And he'd sell the pieces off, and in effect, the company would be dismantled.
Yeah.
And that was a legitimate concern. And then, of course, there's always a defensive posture on the part of corporate executives in any hostile takeover. But Thomas Mellon Evans was his name. He controlled the Crane Company. He purchased a lot of Anaconda Company stock, and the concern was that he would dismember the company, and there would be no more employment in Montana.
And during this same period of time, we were going through the so-called energy crisis.
It was
in the middle 1970s, and so as a result of that, some of the energy companies had really made a lot of money. And one of them was ARCO.
Yeah. ARCO had just...
Atlantic Richfield Company.
Atlantic Richfield Company had just hit it big in Alaska. They, Bob Anderson, who was the chairman of the board, had a wildcat mentality, but he was one of the discoverers of Prudhoe Bay. And all of a sudden, the oil was gushing. He thought it was going to go to $100 a barrel. They had all this cash. And he looked at the Anaconda Company and thought, this looks interesting. He knew about the company. It had a great old tradition. And he thought all they really needed was an infusion of cash, and he could make that, again, into the greatest copper company in the world. So that's what he set out about to do. Meanwhile, I was transferred to Denver. There was an exodus from a lot of places around the country, and Denver became the headquarters for ARCO, Atlantic Richfield, but they maintained the Anaconda Company name. In fact, Bob Anderson restored the original name, the Anaconda Copper Mining Company. So he had a dream that he was going to restore the company to its former greatness.
And you know, I'm not sure people in Montana really ever understood the gravity of the Anaconda Company's problem or what was really happening at that time. I think we were under the impression that the Anaconda Company had always been there and would always be there. I don't think we probably really appreciated the significance of what happened in Chile. And so I think it was somewhat of a surprise when the Anaconda Company was bought out by ARCO.
Well, I think there was, even for those of us that worked there, I had the feeling that the Anaconda Company would be up mining copper in Butte for the next 100 years. I remember arguing with Ted Schwinden when he was, I don't know if he was governor or state lands commissioner, but he wanted to set up a trust fund to provide for people who were thrown out of unemployment in Butte. I said, Ted, this isn't going to happen. Or if it does, it's not going to happen suddenly. It'll be a slow decline. Well, I was wrong about that. It did happen suddenly. We just closed the Butte mines, basically. But when I was down in Denver, Atlantic Richfield began just smothering the company with cash, built up a huge exploration program, and they were a little on the arrogant side. They'd been so successful, they thought the Anaconda Company people were a bunch of clods. They said, we'll come in here and we'll show you how to run a company. And they tried to do that for 3 or 4 years.
This was also during the same period of time that all these transitions, all these things happening where you lost the assets in Chile, were struggling for survival, fought off this corporate raider, this Evans guy. Then the ARCO came to the rescue. And this was also the period in where we were discovering the importance of protecting the environment.
Yes.
So I suppose on both the state and federal level, the Anaconda Company, initially by themselves and then under the ownership of ARCO, is having to deal with a new set of requirements and restrictions and regulations and so on. How important would you say that aspect was in the survival of the company?
Well, it was important. Atlantic Richfield had no concept of the environmental problems that they bought. And that became clear, it's still clear, becoming clear. The oil business doesn't have environmental problems, anything like the mining business does. It's basically a pretty clean business. And you walk into an oil refinery and the floors are all swept and everything is contained in pipes. You go over to a copper smelter and you got flames leaping out of these converters and you got junk all over the floor and smoke belching out of the chimneys. And that's only part of it. You've also got huge mountains of waste material that the oil companies had never had to deal with. And the Anaconda Company is still dealing with those tailings and mine dumps. So I think they were a little bit shocked as this gradually became apparent to them. And as I say, when I came back to Butte, and even when I was working in Denver, the smelter was just a gigantic problem that we just couldn't solve. So we finally shut it down. But that was certainly one of the factors in the demise of the Anaconda Company. I'm talking
the difficulty of coming to terms with the restrictions.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Anaconda Company when it was a division or a part of Atlantic Richfield, because they retained that separate identity for some time, even though it was wholly owned by ARCO.
Gene, getting into kind of the political side or the opinion side of this, I think there are some who would say, gee, if it weren't for the overzealous environmentalists, the Anaconda Company might have remained in business for decades longer. There are others that would say, but my gosh, the environmental atrocities that were being committed then had to be corrected, and it's just too bad that the Anaconda Company or ARCO or whatever was, you know, not able to comply with them. Or do you have any thoughts or analysis on that, on the reasonableness of the restrictions, whether they were imposed too heavy-handedly, whether they were necessary? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. Environmentalists, if whoever they may be, really looked upon the smelter as a blight, and we did crank out an awful lot of sulfur dioxide, And they look upon the mines, tailings, especially people not from Butte, and say, you know, this the company just really raped the earth and really destroyed everything. We tried our best to comply with those requirements, but it just became an almost overwhelming job to do. Now, that wasn't the only reason, and it may not have been the most, probably it was not the most important reason. And in fact, you can go through a number of reasons why the Anaconda Company ultimately failed. One was the environmental costs, and I don't know quite where you'd rank that, but I wouldn't rank it as number one. Other costs were going up, and the grade of the copper was not that good. I mean, our mines weren't that good. We were competing now with Phelps Dodge and Kennecott. They had better mines than we did. And the price of copper also began to sink. So price is the most important single factor when you're producing a commodity. If the price is high, you can get away with anything. But the price of copper dropped way down. And so it was about that time when all of these things began to pile up that the Atlantic Richfield Company decided that they were just going to get out of the copper business. And it came as a big surprise to a lot of people. First we shut the smelter down and had a contract to send our concentrates to Japan, and then one day we just shut the mine down, turned off the pumps, and let the pit fill up. And the people in Butte were befuddled. They didn't just couldn't believe that the Anaconda Company that had been there for 100 years and was supposed to be there for another 100 years could just close up shop and essentially walk away, which is what we did.
I think the whole state felt that way. I think the state didn't really appreciate what was going on in the background here. I think most of the, you know, people in the state, as I've mentioned to you before, were just astounded by this.
Well, one of the things, Bob, is that the Anaconda Company did not have a very high level of credibility because of this somewhat sordid history. People didn't believe the company. And I remember that got into the political race between Schwinden and that guy from Billings. Was the smelter going to be closed? And they were debating it, you know. And the guy from Billings said, oh, they'll never close that smelter. That's just a bluff. And I don't think the company was paying any attention to the politics of it. They just looked at that smelter and said, it's got to go. But people just didn't believe that the company would really do that. The company was... It was almost like a religious feeling in Butte. There was a love-hate relationship between the people of Butte and Anaconda and the company. The company paid good wages. God, they were good jobs. Didn't have to work too hard. Made a lot of money. Good employment. They liked that part of it. But, of course, what they didn't like was the, sort of the heavy-handedness and the domination of the company. And that dichotomy existed right up to the end, but nobody thought the company would ever just walk out, but they did.
Yeah. Any concluding thoughts or anything you'd like to say in summary of your involvement with the Anaconda Company or its collapse?
I think I've said about all that I can say. I think that, in looking back, it was inevitable. Now, that's hindsight. But I never would have anticipated the sea change that was going to occur in the non-ferrous mining industry. You have a tendency to think things are going to go along the way they go along. That's an easy attitude to take. And I don't think... any of us saw that coming, the ARCO people or the Anaconda Company people, until the realization finally crept up on us. But even then, to say, okay, we're going to quit, we're going to give up, and ARCO could have kept on pumping money to the company for some time, but they just decided not to. When it finally happened, it was a bit of a shock. But when I look back, I think it's one of those things that had to happen. The mines weren't good enough, costs were too high, the price was too low. You can't stay in business when all that comes together.
You know, Gene, you and I visited a little bit before, too, about I thought an interesting anecdote. We were talking about this fella, Evans, that was attempting to take over the Anaconda Company, and for a brief period, the company thought, well, perhaps there could be some kind of federal legislation that could protect it from, you know, from this hostile takeover. And you mentioned a wonderful incident that occurred between you and Senator Metcalf when you approached him about helping with that. Do you know that story?
As I said, I never really liked to lobby people, but the people in New York said, we got to put a stop to this thing. They wanted me to go over and talk to Tom Judge and tell him to call a special session. I said, I'm not going to do that. I said, I'm just not going to do that. But
They recommended to you that you have Governor Tom Judge call a special session of the Montana legislature.
Yes.
In some way change the Montana law to make it more difficult for this takeover.
For the takeover,
And of course, there's a precedent in history for that.
Yeah.
When back at the turn of the century, the legislature was convened by Governor Toole to change the, I think, so-called Apex law.
That's correct.
Heinze off the back of the Anaconda Company. And so some people, well, they felt that was probably necessary, at the same time felt it was an example of the big corporation forcing the government to do something that maybe it shouldn't have been forced to do. These fellas, probably not knowing about that history at all, come to you and say, we want something similar done again. And you could see that was a...
Yeah, they were desperate. And I think I may have mentioned that in my article. I said if I tried that, Tom Judge would have laughed me out of his office. And I talked to Tom later, and he said, well, you're probably right. I mean, that would be the death knell of any politician to say we're going to have a special session to save the Anaconda Company. Because for one thing, nobody believed it had to be saved. But I did have to talk to United States senators. And so I gathered some material together. And there was a big labor convention in Great Falls. And the big motel out there south of town was filled, so we had a little hotel room. Alec Hansen was with me. He was my assistant in the PR area. And so I put together a little packet of papers and made appointments with then Congressman Baucus and Senator Metcalf. And Baucus came in with two or three of his staff members, and we had a couple of double beds there, and I sat on one, he sat on the other, and so I started handing this material and telling him what a terrible person Thomas Mellon Evans was, and how if he took the company over, he'd just take it apart, and there'd be no more employment in Butte, and probably spoke for 15 or 20 minutes, And then Baucus stood up and said, well, he said, it's very interesting. He said it and sort of looked off into space and said, if I can ever help you, let me know, and walked out the door. So I thought, well, that was a waste of time. Then a few minutes later, I heard this kind of thumping sound, because Lee Metcalf was limping at that time, coming up the stairs all by himself, no staff. And we'd met before. We didn't know each other very well. He sat on one, but I sat on the other. And I started handing this material to him. And he listened to me, and when I finished, I'll never forget what he said. He said, I'm not a garden farmer from New Jersey. He said, I'm not a fly fisherman from Vermont. He said, I'm from Montana. He said, and I want employment for Montana. He said, I'm going to go back to Washington and do something about this. And it was just, and then he said, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. So what he was saying is that the best thing he could do for Montana, even though he had no great love for the Anaconda Company, was to try to save it from this guy. So he sure as hell did. He went back there and set up a select committee, which without jurisdiction, I'm sure, and got Hall Thomas Mellon Evans up there in front of his committee and accused him of trying to buy the Anaconda Company with Chinese money. And it created a little bit of a stir and probably didn't do much good. You never know. But Lee Metcalf he was willing to kind of put his heart into it and do what he thought was best for the people of Montana, because he knew how much employment was involved. And then it was shortly after that Bob Anderson came riding in on his white horse, the Atlantic Richfield horse, and bought the Anaconda Company. And he made a deal with Evans, too, to buy his stock and put the whole thing together.
Yeah, and he had the money to do it.
Oh, he had tons of money, yeah.
Now, just we've just got a few minutes left in our tape here, but, I'm fascinated to know, did you ever have a working relationship in any of your work with the Anaconda Company with Senator Mansfield?
No. I met him once. I barely knew him. He was aloof. He was a statesman, and he was a little bit above what the Anaconda Company was doing. And I heard people complain about Mansfield, who'd been there years before I was, that he was just, if he wanted to get something done, he was not necessarily the best guy to go see. He would attend a few events in Washington that the company put on, luncheons or breakfasts for senators and congressmen, but he was a very passive person in terms of his involvement with the company, as far as I know.
How about Congressman Dick Shoup, Congressman Arnold Olson?
Well, they were there and then gone. I didn't know Shoup. I knew Olson when he came back to Butte and became a judge, but I really don't know anything at all about how he was to work with from the Anaconda Company standpoint. I think most of those guys, even whatever their personal political proclivities might have been, felt they had to kind of watch themselves around the company. You know, they didn't want to declare war on the company, and maybe in some quiet way they may have helped, but I really can't give you anything specific about Arnold Olson.
Governor Forrest Anderson?
No, I don't know. I can remember coming into Tom Judge's office and also going over to the Attorney General's office with a letter asking them to do something about an environmental problem. And my recollection is that not much of anything was done. Yeah, so it's not like the old days when, you know, 30 or 40 years before that, when the Western General Counsel of the Anaconda Company called up the Attorney General and said, I want something done, and chances are he'd do it for him. Yeah. Dan Kelly, you know, was Attorney General of the state at one time, and he later became Western General Counsel of the Anaconda Company.
That was so, considered a promotion.
Yeah, that's right. So there was a little bit of incest involved there.
Anything else?
I can't think of anything, Bob.
Well, I sure appreciate the interview, Gene.
Well, I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.